This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. On the show this week, a phone call from the land of the midnight sun with a deputy premier talking about the Northern Lights, the porcupine caribou, and his memories of growing up in Cape Breton. Also, celebrating 100 years of a Canadian icon with a conversation about a stubborn Cape Breton politician and a colorful skipper during the golden age of sail. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Ranch Pillay grew up in Cape Breton. The son of a surgeon and nurse, he inherited the instincts to roll up his sleeves and work towards being a community leader, trying to help people as much as possible. But the path he chose was in politics rather than medicine. That path he took, by the way, is a very long one. He doesn't live in Cape Breton anymore. He migrated just about as far away as possible from Cape Breton while still remaining in Canada, all the way to the Yukon. But he hasn't forgotten his roots in Inverness County and gets back to the island as much as possible to see his clan here. Ranj is now the deputy premier way up there, and his buddy from high school is the premier. He eventually heard the call of the North, and he says he couldn't resist answering it.
So I've spent most of my early life growing up in Cape Breton. I grew up in Inverness and the Brook Village area, and then attended school as well in Mabu and Judic. So from when I was growing up and living in Cape Breton, or in Brook Village, I went to school from grade 5 to grade 9 in Mabu, and then I attended grade 10. I attended school in Judic, and then moved to Anakinish for grade 11 and 12.
And how did you end up in the Yukon?
You know what? There's a number of folks that I went to high school with, including the premier, that had, after graduating from St. Evex or other universities, had made a decision to move to the Yukon. A lot of them are teachers. Some other folks work in the public service. So, I had kept in touch with a number of those individuals and had played lots of sports. Good friends from playing basketball, and they invited me to come out and see what the opportunities were.
Yes, of course, the Premier, Sandy Silver, Premier of the Yukon, is also from Nova Scotia. And you mentioned there was a group of friends from high school. So what was it about the Yukon that attracted the Premier and his friends Northwest?
I think just the opportunities. I mean, I believe at that time, it was more of a challenging time to find opportunities in the education field, and for many of those folks who were teachers, they moved out and they first, you know, found great opportunities for employment, as well as folks that had different backgrounds, whether it was in the private sector or public service, also found opportunities. And then it's just a lifestyle. I mean, it's an absolutely, Yukon's just an absolutely amazing, beautiful place. If you enjoy being in the outdoors, whether it's hunting, fishing, mountain biking, you know, skidooing, you name it, there's so many things, hiking, climbing. I mean, it has it all. So I think once, you know, a lot of those folks had a chance to live here, and then they, you know, really just embraced all the different opportunities in the lifestyle, and you know, and then folks get a little bit older, and they, you know, and in many cases they ended up meeting the spouses that they're with now, and they've brought their families up here. So most of our friend group will probably have been here for at least 20 years plus. And so, yeah, people just, I mean, I think that Yukon's one of those places where people, they come for a visit and they fall in love and they never leave, usually.
You know, I find that interesting when you have provincial leaders from the East Coast up in Canada's North, like many communities. Is there something there what you might call the old guard when they talk about new people coming to a community, you know, come from a ways? Is it like that in the Yukon? Do you feel that you're at home, or are you still a visitor there?
I think people are very I find it a bit different than other parts of Canada in the sense that, I think the Yukon's the type of place where if you come and you work hard and you contribute to the community, it's home, right? People are going to support you in the community as if it's your home. And I think it's because when you think about the history of the Yukon, even folks that have been here for, let's say families that have been here for a couple of generations, it's in the most case, it's still all been since, the late 1800s, early 1900s. So I do think that, a lot of folks, whether it was the building of the Alaska Highway and their families came and they stayed. So, I still think there's folks that you're still seeing generations of the first individuals that were actually born in the Yukon or the second generation that was born in the Yukon. So I feel that people are very welcoming. Growing up in Cape Breton, it's a bit different. I always think about, there's a great story. There's a guy that I worked with in Inverness, and he ended up, he had a heart attack, and they had to medevac him from Inverness to Halifax. And the Inverness Orne, I believe it was, had in the paper the following week, local man medevaced from Inverness. And he said, man, I had to have a heart attack and be medevaced to ever be called the local man. So, Cape Breton can be a little bit different. It's like deep, deep, deep roots. My family's probably been, on my mom's side, they've been in the same area for six generations, like between Lake Ainslie and Brook Village. Family's been in that area. So, those are pretty deep roots as well. And I also hear the difference is, the folks that have been here for thousands of years is all of the First Nations individuals that are in the Yukon, and it's very vibrant, strong Indigenous culture, of course, in the Yukon as well.
It's nearly 7,000 kilometers from Cape Breton to Whitehorse. And if there was a highway across the Atlantic Ocean going to Ireland, that would only be about half the way from here to Whitehorse. But if you were driving that same distance, I think it's to Greece, if you were to measure that on the map. And it really gives you an idea of the enormous size of Canada. And you went from one end on the east all the way to the other side. And do you still feel like that you're in Canada when you're that far away from your roots here in Cape Breton?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's, Whitehorse is a special place because it's a capital of the territory. Even though the population's only, it's 40,000, it really punches above its weight as a community, because there is always national events coming here, or it's a capital city. So I think just because the Yukon is such an amazing place. I mean, before COVID, after PEI, the second biggest per capita GDP contributor for tourism is the Yukon after PEI. So you have a lot of people traveling through. We have in the summertime, we have a direct flight from Frankfurt, Germany, right to Whitehorse. So you've got international travel coming here as well. So I think it's a very vibrant city, but also I believe that at least in the role I'm in as well. I mean, I'm at the table with ministers from across the country, throughout the year, and I'm on calls. And so absolutely, I feel like it's part of Canada. It's really fun living here as well, though, because you can also, I can drive an hour and a half from Whitehorse south and be, having dinner in Alaska, in Skagway, Alaska, on the Pacific. It's just over a mountain pass into a beautiful small community. That's a big tourism destination called Skagway. Or we can drive north and I could be in Anchorage, Alaska. And that's, pretty interesting as well. I mean, Anchorage is a U.S. city with a lot of military infrastructure and a lot of industry. So it is, it's kind of, that's fun to be able to be, have that, part of the United States that close to us. But no, I think, you know, there's so many people from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Western Canada. There's people from all over other parts of Canada that have made the Yukon their home. There's a long history going back to the gold rush off as well from people from Nova Scotia who, from the Anakinish area, that were, you know, philanthropic activity they were took part in, giving to the community in Dawson City, or were renowned prospectors during the gold rush. So, I mean, that connection even between Nova Scotia and the Yukon has been strong right from, you know, the point of contact with First Nations groups right to today.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the relationship with the U.S. And there was a fun fact that I wanted to mention later, but Mount Logan is the second highest peak in all of North America, an elevation nearly 6 kilometers, the highest peak in North America, next door to you guys in Alaska. And that's in the Denali, Alaskan range. That's just over 6 kilometers. So where you share a border with Alaska of the U.S. in the Yukon, is the American influence any different there and vice versa than it would be on the East Coast, for example, the New Brunswick border with Maine?
No, I think that in many cases, I think Alaskans, there's a real connection between Alaskans and folks from the Yukon, just because of the similarities in interests, whether it's, you know, fishing or hunting or the outdoors and some of the industry that's there, whether it be, you know, the mining industry. There's activity happening on both sides of the border. I don't see as much U.S. influence in the sense that sort of U.S. pop culture. I don't see it as that as much, and I think that that you might see in, you know, on the border between New Brunswick and Maine or other areas. It's, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie. We play, especially in the wintertime, there's basketball tournaments that happen where there's teams that come in at the high school level, even in adult club teams that come from Alaska to into the Yukon. And there's a, you know, sort of a long history of that. Of course, we share there's a long dog sled race called the Yukon Quest, and that 1 year it starts in the Yukon, the next year it starts in Alaska. So lots of camaraderie. When you talk about First Nations communities, I mean, of course, you know, when governments come into place, they draw imaginary lines. And of course, our First Nations communities predate that. So you've got First Nations communities throughout the Yukon that have citizens that live in Alaska, as well as citizens that are living in the Yukon, and people are traveling back and forth, you know, to see their friends and relatives. So there is, I mean, there's a lot of camaraderie and a lot of back and forth between both the Yukon as well as Alaska.
How are you adjusting to the long winter nights and long summer days? I wonder, is that something that you ever get used to?
No, I think in the wintertime, well, of course, this year was interesting because we actually passed legislation and put our own time zone in place. So there's Yukon time. We were looking to coordinate that with British Columbia. British Columbia is still working to coordinate with Oregon State and Washington State, because there's a lot of economic activity in that area, especially in the tech sector. So they're trying to coordinate. But we went forward with it. So our, you know, what it meant was that it was darker this winter in the mornings. And, you know, in my world, you know, you get up and you get ready for work and you go. And it's, you know, it's dark when you're there. Now, the difference was we had a little bit more light at the end of the day throughout the year. So you'd get back from work and you'd still, you know, have a bit of light. I think in the wintertime, people in the Yukon just stay really busy. You're either skiing or you're skidooing or you're playing hockey or you're, you know, you're playing basketball or volleyball or soccer. I mean, we've got really, really great infrastructure in the Yukon specifically, as well as Whitehorse has great infrastructure. You know, we hosted the Canada Games a number of years ago. We have a complex here and, you know, continue to add to it. So I think people just tend to stay really busy. We have, you know, the cross-country ski club has, you know, a very robust membership. So you have, people are doing stuff throughout the winter, and I think that's really the key. In the summertime, you know, it is the energy level is immense, because we're just hitting that season right now. And it will be, you know, it's still sort of, you know, you still get some light. I think sunset right now is 9:30 or 9:45, but, you know, that's sunset. So it's still kind of bright even later than that. So you're just very active. You can be, you know, the difference between you could be golfing at, you know, 10 o'clock at night, or you could be, you know, sitting in a boat fishing at 11 o'clock at night. And I think people really just embrace that opportunity and use it. I think real simple things, you know, in your household, you're going to have, you know, blackout curtains, so you can make sure you can sleep when it's time to sleep. But, you know, I don't find it, I think it's something we all really look forward to the summer and to having all that time and to go out and do all the things everybody loves to do. And in the wintertime, you just sort of, you know, embrace it and go at it. It was tough. I mean, we just ran an election, and it was, you know, not normal to have that weather that we did. I think the Friday, it was really an anomaly. I mean, the Friday, I was out knocking on doors. I think it was minus 25. I spent like 7 hours out on the last week before the election day. So that was a little bit of a surprise, and we had lots of snow. We had more snow this particular year than we've had in 50 years. So it's, you know, changing climate and things such as that. But overall, I mean, you get used to the, you know, the seasonality in light.
Sure. Of course, a paradise for people who like kayaking, canoeing, and hiking. The Yukon tourism motto, larger than life. But those long winter nights where, you know, you might think that most people just want to settle in by the fireplace, there is something extraordinary up that way, Aurora Borealis. And I was just wondering, the first time that you looked up and you saw the sky dancing above your head there with all these different colors and just this electric type of atmosphere, what did you think about that? And how would you describe that to someone who hasn't seen it that closely before?
Yeah, I think it's something that everybody needs to at some point hopefully see in their life. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, you would get touches off it in Nova Scotia. You know, I think, you know, growing up, or people would point stuff out to me, not as vibrant. Here it's incredible. And what a lot of people are not aware of, you know, they think it's going to be in the midst of winter. But we actually, you know, even over the last month, we've had absolutely exceptional northern lights. And in September, we're starting to get a lot of tourism because folks, you know, it's still warmer, and it's a good time to come and see the northern lights. Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, it just, you just need to, it didn't matter how cold out it was just to take a moment and sit and to watch this, you know, spectacular show off, you know, many, many different colors and just how spectacular it is across the entire sky. I mean, and also here, you can imagine how special it is to people. We have folks flying in from across the world to be in the Yukon to be able to watch that. And so it means so much to so many people. And I think we're lucky enough now with social media. People probably get to see people posting on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever it may be, you know, as almost in real time. And so folks get a chance to see what it is. But when you're sitting out and watching it, it is, it's something to behold.
And something else that is quite the sight to see up there, it's one of the longest mammal migrations in the world, and that happens there in the Yukon Territory, and that involves 200,000 porcupine caribou.
Yeah, the population, there's been a lot of work to sustain that population. A lot of the conversation that was happening under the previous U.S. administration around opening up oil development in Alaska was, you know, a lot of Yukoners have kept a close eye on that because the migration pattern is from the eastern part of Alaska over to the Yukon, and there's been fears over different periods of time about impacts to calving grounds. And it's an amazing thing to see. I haven't watched sort of the larger herd moving. I haven't had an opportunity to see it in person, but I have hunted in that area and you know, usually hunting smaller groups that are broken off from the main herd. So you can still harvest, and you know, Yukoners are allowed to harvest two caribou per year, and so you're allowed to hunt that group of caribou, or you can hunt mountain caribou, which is also bigger caribou that are here all year long. They're not migrating the same way.
And what about moose? So there are about 70,000 moose there. There are more moose in the Yukon than there are people. Is that something? Do you have a lot of outfitters in the Yukon, and a lot of course, pre-COVID for outfitting type activities for hunting and fishing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's quite a few moose that are actually, you know, harvested in Cape Breton when you look at the annual harvest. But yeah, there's moose hunting here is really part of everybody's you know, year. That's usually, you know, August, more September. People are going out in their hunting moose, and there's absolutely lots of everybody locally goes and hunts. Our large portion of our population does. There's about 20 outfitting concessions in the Yukon. Still, last year was a tough year for outfitters. They had, because they really only had Canadian clients, and normally they have European, U.S., and Canadian clients, and the Yukon is, when it comes to hunting, I mean, the Yukon is looked upon as sort of, you know, one of the epicenter. I mean, this is, whether it's, there's so many amazing hunting experiences that are available, right? From hunting caribou to moose to bison to doll sheep, like some of the most amazing hunting in the world happens in Yukon. So yeah, there's a very strong outfitting industry here still that goes back to, you know, again, you know, over 100 years.
You mentioned the gold rush there earlier, and something I wanted to ask you, the Klondike gold rush, that was 100,000 people in the late 1800s flocked to the area, and of course you're the deputy premier, but you're also the minister responsible for mining, and can you talk about mining being a primary economic driver there in the Yukon? Does that also draw people from all over the world to be involved with that industry?
Yeah, it's our largest contributor to in the private sector. Right now we have three operating mines. We have Canada's only primary silver mine has reopened, and it's in an area that has a long, long history as a silver district. We have Canada's newest gold mine had opened about 2 years ago, and that is Victoria Gold, and it's the largest gold mine that's ever been built in Yukon, and that's running as well. And there's also a copper mine, which is about just a couple hours north of Whitehorse, and it's also had a bit of a history where it had opened and closed, and now it reopened while we're in government. So yeah, I mean, it's fun. You know, I would say this, I believe that the contractors that are still working at Minto Mine or Mabu Mining. So how funny would that be? You know, so it's always interesting when you're, you know, you're in the role of Minister of Mines, and you know, your centerman and your left winger from your Adam hockey team in Mabu happen to be mining in the Yukon. So there's a whole bunch of folks that have a strong background in mining, and that are that fly back and forth to Yukon as well to work in Minto.
I'm just wondering, someone from your old stomping ground in Inverness County that they would enjoy in the Yukon. You have an official tartan there, and it's registered on the official Scottish tartan registry. It's light blue. It has a light blue background. It's white, yellow, green, and dark blue stripes. And the reason I mention that is just because I think it's a multicultural community as well, and there are 8 First Nations languages in the Yukon. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's some of the languages that people are really striving to keep in place, of course, like, which is happening. And it's there's 11 self-governing First Nations, so that's the breakdown. There's 11 self-governing First Nations, which means they have what we call a modern treaty with Canada and the Yukon, and then there's 3 other First Nations that still work under the Indian Act. So 14 different First Nation communities, very similar to Nova Scotia, And you're absolutely correct. Yeah, there's a tartan. There's a Yukon tartan that that we all from time to time wear, whether it's on tartan days or on Yukon day, we wear that tie or pin. And but it is very much a cultural. I mean, you know, going back to that other point, there's not just the mining side, but exploration. I mean, there's investment from around the world that comes into the Yukon when it's looking in the exploration industry. And we've been, you know, we're usually sort of in the top of the heap when it comes to the mining sector. I just want to touch on one thing. We have a placer mining industry as well. So, you know, you folks will see it, you know, on TV, you'll see Gold Rush or some of those shows that show a different type of mining. So it's not underground mining, and it's not mining that would be done in an open pit, but it's actually, you know, the use of hydro from water to process the gravels. And that industry last year had it was a record year, but I think it was almost 19,000 ounces of gold that were extracted in the Yukon, primarily in Dawson City, 150 different operations. Those operations could go from anywhere from 3 or 4 people to 50 people working at them. So really significant contributor as well, probably somewhere between $150 to $200 million into the economy, and that's usually about a 120-day season. So so there's your traditional, your placer mining that still continues on. That's what folks were doing during the gold rush, and then, of course, you know, with new technology. So yes, that brings people from around the world. There's people that come in mine from New Zealand and Australia in the placer industry, as well as investing in our other more traditional mining sector. And we do have a number of mines we have that are on the horizon right now that are going through a regulatory process, as well as the biggest gold mining company in the world, which is Newmont, Goldcorp, which is Newmont, is now has a big project in the Yukon, and they're looking at some pretty extensive investment. So, yeah, mining's, we travel the world meeting with folks in the investment side of things, and really, you know, a very long, strong history of mining here. And you're right, all of those things have contributed to a very diverse community. I mean, we have per capita the second biggest immigration from France to any province or territory after Quebec. So we have a very strong Francophone community. Of course, we have an extremely vibrant and strong Indigenous community. And, you know, very similar to Nova Scotia, a lot of folks that have traveled and made this their home from Germany that love to be in the outdoors. And so it's very eclectic. And even over the last number of years, we have people immigrating, you know, from China and India, but really from the Philippines. The city of Whitehorse, almost, I think it's almost 20% of the population of Whitehorse is people that have moved from the Philippines. So it is a very, you know, very international in the sense of the people that make up this community, as well as our smaller communities throughout the Yukon.
You know, I was wondering if you could explain places like the Yukon or the NWT in Nunavut being called territories compared to southern Canada, where, of course, we have provinces. What are the pros and cons when it comes to that distinction, whether or not a place is called a territory or a province?
Yeah, I mean, it really has to do with the relationship with Canada. And in this particular case, I mean, we have, you know, significant transfer agreement that's in place. And when it comes to how the oversight here, I mean, we went through a process of devolution. So in many ways, a lot of things that were governed by the federal government in the early 2000s until now, we've drawn down those responsibilities, whether it's the responsibility over our resources or the responsibility over our lands. But still, it is a unique relationship. We have the Yukon Act, which is a federal piece of legislation, which is a key to the relationship between between Canada and the Yukon. And, you know, of course, provinces have, there's more anonymity between the decision-making process of the provinces compared to the territories. I mean, there's been interest. I think, it's not been an active conversation. There has been interest in the past where people have thought about, wanting to have, more of a provincial relationship with Canada. But I think for, I think at this point in time, we, as a government, we're constantly looking at ways to be able to create our own source revenue so that we can be independent and not have to be reliant to the same extent on Canada or all Canadians, like any province. You know, we want to be able to contribute our, our share. But it's also, I think as an early, as a place in Canada where, there is just over 40,000 people, in your due diligence that you do, you have looked at, you see it's a massive territory, that we have to govern and to take care of. And so I think, at this point in the path of the Yukon, I think it's continuing to be a territory is something that, is probably best at this point in time. But, in the future, who knows?
You mentioned, of course, about the territories taking up a large portion of the country. In the north, two of those territories have what's called a consensus style of government, and basically no political parties. The elected officials are basically independents, and they select the premier. Is this something that you and your colleagues with the government in the Yukon, is there any discussion involving that, or are you pretty set in your ways now that you would remain with party politics?
Yeah, I see there's no active conversation about a change. We're in the midst right now of coming out of an election, and as governing party, we're in the midst of discussions, and this will be the first time that there will be a minority government, and so this is new for the Yukon. It's to where there's got to be that work across the aisle to make sure, that you can build support to govern. And I think that's in many ways for a lot of Yukoners, I think they're finding that quite refreshing. They're not afraid of, what a minority government, but they feel probably that a larger amount of the population will be able to see themselves in the policies that are moving forward versus just one party. I've had discussions with, of course, my colleagues that are elected in Northwest Territories and colleagues that are elected in Nunavut. I've heard mixed reviews. I've heard, sometimes it's there's a real, they embrace it, and certainly when I visited Yellowknife or Iqaluit, it's been presented as, a very, they embrace that system, and that's the system of governance they have. I have heard it's difficult sometimes to move certain policies forward because of that structure of consensus versus party politics. But the Yukon's had strong party politics and strong representation in Ottawa, even at the MP level, for a long, long time. When you think about the Yukon, when you think about Cape Breton, you think about folks like Alan Jay, who, was a deputy prime minister for a long, long time and had a very, strong history in Canada. And around that same time period, the deputy prime minister as well, from when government would switch was Mr. Nielsen, who was from the Yukon. So Yukon is going back to the Black family, just after the turn of the century. There's been strong, strong party politics in Yukon for a long time, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
You know, just if you don't mind me mentioning, just a bit off topic, but you mentioned Mr. Nielsen. Of course, he was a deputy prime minister under Brian Mulroney, and he had a very famous brother. Is that right? We may know him as a comedian and actor.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the family's strong here. They're strong. His son is a strong leader in the private sector still, in the with one of our big Air North, which is one of our local companies here that is partially owned by First Nations and is a really strong regional carrier. It was named one of the best, I think the best airline in Canada just before COVID. So Mr. Nielsen still works there, and yeah, there's lots of grandchildren and family members that are all still very active in the Yukon.
Yeah, his brother Leslie, very famous in the movie Airplane and the Naked Gun series. Yeah.
That's right.
We're big
That's
fans
right.
here.
That's right.
Deputy Premier, you're very generous with your time. I would like to ask you before we go, what do you miss most about Cape Breton, or is there anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked you about during this interview?
Yeah, no, I would say that it's really interesting to reflect back on growing up in Inverness and Brook Village and Mabu, and I look back at that time period so fondly because people were so kind. There's just so many that were supportive and helped help me along the way. And I always I'm back and forth communicating with all those folks all the time. That experience, I think, is just so special. We don't have that opportunity as much anymore. Growing up in Inverness as a young fella, it was this very safe community, and you could walk and visit people, and that's certainly what I did. And all of those individuals along the way were so kind, and lots of elders in the community that were so kind. Thinking back to, where you get your work ethic of, it means a lot to me to be in the role here as a Minister of Mines, because my grandfather, who was a farmer from Brook Village, spent a lot of time in Kirkland Lake and in Ontario and Quebec as an underground miner. We talked a lot about that. My uncles are retired miners. Steve McClellan lives in Sydney, and Ken McClellan lives in Sudbury. And so, there was a bit of a family connection to mining. And so it meant a lot to be able to do this. And having the work ethic instilled, whether it was throwing bales of hay or, whatever the work was growing up, all of those things are, pretty unique in this day and age to have those experiences and to learn from that. So what I miss, I'm pretty comfortable in the water, and I'm pretty comfortable at the beach. And my childhood was, a large portion of my childhood was either at the beach in Inverness or the beach in Mabu coal mines. And so, I always miss when I don't get to spend a bit of time there. Those are all things that mean lots. And I think just the sense of community. I mean, Cape Breton is just such an amazing place. And there's so many people in Cape Breton that are continuing to contribute to the success of Cape Breton, which is great to see. I've had the opportunity as well to, there's lots of Cape Bretoners around Canada and in unique positions, whether it's, Lisa Raid at CIBC now, or Kevin Lynch, who was the clerk, of course, of the Privy Council, head of the Canadian government, really public service, and then went off to Bank of Montreal. Just neat people, and I try to always keep an eye out, Gerald Butts, you name it. I mean, there's just so many folks that are making a difference, but also keep a place in their heart for Cape Breton, and they all try to get back and spend time there when they can. So those are the things I think about, and certainly any chance I get to take my wife and my two boys back there, we do.
Thank you.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the launch of the Queen of the North Atlantic, the Bluenose. Although its port of registry was in Lunenburg, it became a national pride. You'll find its image on the Nova Scotia license plate, and when you find yourself with a pocket full of change, you'll see it right there on the back of a dime. During its time on the water, the Nova Scotia schooner was the undefeated champion of the International Fisherman's Trophy. And this week, we hear from Ashley Newell, an Ottawa-based writer and researcher, and he tells us about Cape Breton's connection, as well as her first captain, Angus Walters. The conversation here just scratches the surface on the story of the Bluenose. You can find out more at ashleynewell.ca. That's his website. He starts out talking about what sparked his interest in the Bluenose.
Well, as a yacht racer myself, I certainly admire the prowess of the Bluenose. I admire the colorfulness of Captain Walters. They were out there. They wanted to, you know, for me, I like inland lakes and rivers. I don't like it too choppy. They liked it as choppy as possible, as windy as possible. And they had national, regional pride, in their hearts and minds. So, God bless them.
The name Bluenose, term used, I believe, in the late 1700s after the American Revolution. It was a reverend in the Annapolis Valley. He was a loyalist, but he called the local people Bluenosers, and he didn't seem to use that as a term of endearment. But I thought people were called Bluenosers because of the ship, but it seems it's the other way around.
So the Bluenose 2 office in Lunenburg actually gave me their understanding of the story. And that is that the Annapolis Valley was sending potatoes down to New England, and the New Englanders thought the potatoes looked like blue noses.
Oh, okay. I always wondered about that. Which came first, the ship named Blue Nose, or Nova Scotians called Blue Nosers? But fast forward to 1921, a ship is built in Nova Scotia, and as you say in your research, if it wasn't for a stubborn Cape Bretoner who lived up in the northern part of the island here, a member of Parliament, maybe it would never have set sail at all. Can you tell us about that, Ashley, please?
Absolutely, and it's more of an indirect link than a direct link. So Alexander Ross's intervention, the MP's intervention, lodging a Canadian challenge for the America's Cup, those ideas were then turned into or became the Fisherman's Cup, the International Fisherman's Cup, which was initially sponsored by the Halifax Herald. And then at the first Fisherman's Cup in October, early November 1920, Canada lost to the U.S. boat. And so the organizers thought to themselves, we need to build a yacht that's going to defeat the Americans. And at that point, the Bluenose was conceived. So in terms of how the, where the initial idea for the Fisherman's Cup came, that is a matter of conjecture. I argue that that Cape Bretoner Alex Ross made a substantial contribution. Now, whether his idea then turned into the idea of a guy named Colin McKay, he wrote the first article for the Halifax Herald called Why Not a Fisherman's Race for Canada and the States? So whether or not he had that idea independently or unconsciously was sort of going with the momentum that was coming from Ross's bid, which was national news, front page news from coast to coast, he may have, come by that idea independently. Similarly, William Dennis, the publisher of William Dennis II, the publisher of the Halifax Herald, may also have come by the idea independently to have a schooner race. But basically, Alex Ross, he came first. He had the idea first. And the most important part of his bid or his challenge was he was going to challenge with Nova Scotia fishermen as crew. And so that was the seed itself of the idea for the Fisherman's Cup. Now, again, whether or not the other two key players were taking from that or had come by their ideas independently, only they would know.
The Blue Nose is a schooner, and what makes this type of vessel different from other tall ships like a brig? Or how do you know a schooner when you see it?
That's a very good question. My focus for much of the of my research wasn't on schooners versus sloops or you know types of vessels. The main thing, though, about the schooners was that was what Nova Scotia fishermen were using for fishing and had been for a long time. Now, by 1920, motorboats were starting to come in, and that way of life was starting to go out. The America's Cup, the 1920 America's Cup, they were sailing sloops, which were built specifically for racing, whereas the schooners were built ultimately, when it came to the Fisherman's Cup, for racing and for fishing, and that was a key point for Nova Scotia fishermen, that you know these boats that were these mere racing machines, as they called them, were you know weren't gritty enough. So that would be the main difference: the sloops in the 1920 America's Cup, just for racing; the schooners for the Fisherman's Cup, in particular, for racing and for fishing.
And for it to be such a force compared to other ships, racing ships, it required the best seamen, obviously, to operate it, including its captains. And the first skipper, Angus James Walters, born in 1881, and he was in charge from the launch of the Blue Nose until 1938. I did try to find some audio of Captain Walters speaking. It was hard to come by, and sometimes it's good to hear the actual voice of someone who played a pivotal role in Nova Scotia's history. So here's a part of a documentary where the narrators describe a situation involving the design of the Blue Nose, actually, and how Captain Walters spoke about his own instincts and questions during the construction of the vessel. And the clip explains it a little bit better here, and you'll hear Walters speak near the end of the clip. Can I just play that for you for a second?
Please do.
Angus Walters was chosen to be the master of the Blue Nose because he had a track record. He had proven that he could handle a vessel. I remember, still they're still fishing, so he was a fish killer. He could find a trip of fish, so that was important. And also, he was able to handle a crowd of men. And he had that extra spite, that little bit of spunk that seemed to work.
Angus came to know and love every inch of the Blue Nose during the months of construction. With a barely concealed passion, he watched as the schooner began to take shape.
Angus was at the shipyard every day. And that's when you begin to see a little bit of that streak of independence that Captain Angus Walters had. Because as he began to watch the vessel take shape, he said, "My men aren't midgets," he said. "They know in the forecastle." And so if you look at photographs of the original Blue Nose, you will see what is called a knuckle on the bow. And that knuckle was created by the added 18 inches that Angus Walters insisted go in place. And Bill Ruiz said to his last that it actually slowed the Blue Nose down.
No, it didn't slow her down.
And so, in a TV interview, Angus attempted to answer his critics.
He thinks that by raising her up and you're hauled by what we call by the wind, there was that much more wood higher up in the air. But on the other hand, then when we were off of the wind, there was that much more wood up higher in the air than that. So I don't think it affected them one way or the other. I wouldn't say so anyway.
In other words, it worked for you and it worked against you.
And on the other hand, that raising her up for her still made her a drier boat in bad weather or in a day that we had a fairly good breeze than if it would have been down 18 inches lower. More water was going to come over. The more come over, had to go back off of the deck and run off of it.
Yep.
See? You never want water on deck when you're racing if you can help it.
On March 26, 1921, the Blue Nose was launched. It was a big day for Lunenburg and Nova Scotia. The love affair between the captain and the queen had begun.
What can you tell us about Captain Walters? He must have had great leadership skills, among other talents.
He was a very gritty man, and he was a very humorous man, and he was obviously an incredible skipper. And certainly, you know, the book that I read that listed the top three skippers, you know, in Canadian history, he wasn't on that list, but it seems to me as though he should be. And, you know, there's a picture up on my website there in the story of showing Angus Walters driving for the finish line. The yacht just heeled right over. It's certainly the most incredible photo of the Blue Nose that I've ever seen. So, you know, so he was hard driving. He took risks. And in terms of the Blue Nose build itself, he was there from day one. You know, he was in the initial schooner trials in October 1920. He just lost by a hair, but I believe he crewed with the winning yacht in the first 1920 Fisherman's Cup. And then at the meeting on November 15th, 1920, when they decided to build the Blue Nose, he was there. So he was there right from the start and all the way through the process.
Well, I think that's all the questions I had there for you, Ashley. That's very good stuff. Is there anything you'd like to add about the Blue Nose or an anecdote that our listeners might enjoy about the ship?
Well, I guess the thing that comes to mind is the pivot point, and that is 10 days after the Cape Bretoner Alexander C. Ross launched the Canadian Challenge, which never happened, by the way. He wanted to raise $1 million from the public, and that's where the stubborn part comes in, because right off the bat he was offered the money from some rich BC yachtsmen, and he turned it down. He said, this is a matter of national interest. And so he was very passionate about the patriotic side of things, and he wouldn't listen to anybody that he should, you know, take the money and run. He wanted to raise it from ordinary Canadians, and obviously the Blue Nose herself is a very patriotic ship, and so that aspect of his dream did come true. And by the way, the Blue Nose is doing a Sail Pass tour again this summer. And, you know, I follow them on Twitter. I do a lot of my, or put out a lot of my research on the various aspects of Canadian history on Twitter. And I, all the way back here in Ontario, I was inspired by the Sail Pass tour that they did last summer. Obviously, they can't do tours of the boat this summer, I don't believe. But, you know, they will be coming through there, I'm quite certain.
Okay, we're just going to wrap up with a song that we like to play here on the coast every now and again. It's called The Blue Nose by the late, great Stan Rogers. And thanks so much for your time, Ashley. It was great to speak to you today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So does she not take wing like a living thing, child of the moving tide? See her pass with grace on the water's face with clean and quiet pride. Our own tall ship of great renown still lifts unto the sky. Who will know the Blue Nose in the sun? Who will know the Blue Nose in the sun? Who will know the Blue Nose in the sun? Who will know the Blue Nose in the sun?
That's all for Dialogue this week on the Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue three times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.